All right. Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for making it through the snow this morning to be here with us for Adult Education. I'm Thais Carter, one of the members of the Adult Ed Committee, and it is my great pleasure to welcome you to the Quran, Text, Context, and Interpretation with Tahsin Taver, who is an assistant professor of religion and Islam at Princeton University. She teaches courses on the Quran and its interpretation, Sufism and Muslim ethics, Muslim humanities, Shiism, and religion and the culture of Iran. Her research focuses on the multiple forms of Muslims' engagement with scripture, pre-modern and modern, oral and textual, interpretive and performative. It is an honor to have her with us here today, so join me in welcoming Professor Taver.
Maybe we reduce the... Thank you so much. Testing at the same time. Testing. Don't want to damage ears. How are we doing? Yeah, that's good. I think so. Everyone can hear me in the back? Yeah. So welcome. Thank you so much for being here. As a very dear friend of mine always says, I think one of the most precious gifts anybody can give each other in these days is the gift of their time. So really, thank you for coming, for your interest, for your curiosity, and I look forward to our conversation. The way that we will hold this session is that I will give a little bit of a lecture, but we will also have some group discussion in the middle. We will look at a primary source, which is a text from the Quran, and we'll have some chance for discussing it amongst ourselves and then coming back as a large group. So hopefully there'll be ample time for you to participate and engage as well, not just to have me talk at you, which is not my best style of teaching, or for you to for listening. So I'm going to say a few statements, and I want you to tell me what's problematic in what I'm saying. Islam says, be good to your neighbors. Or let's say Islam says, be good to your brothers. Christianity says, be good to your neighbors. Buddhism says, don't participate in any forms of violence. Someone stop me if possible. What's problematic about the framing of my sentence? Islam says, be good to your brothers. Christianity says, da-da-da-da-da. Yeah. Traditions, exactly. Religions are not abstractions. They are not people that speak. They are not someone that lives. Islam is not someone that lives down on Jefferson Street that we can knock on their door and say, hey, what do you say about, kidney transplantation? Is it permissible? Is it not permissible? So we want to move away from thinking about religions as abstractions that can say and do things. And instead, we want to not freeze the tradition into these abstractions, especially in the case of Islam, where there is no central authority that decides what does and doesn't count as Islam. There's no central orthodoxy, which is to say, that decides what does and doesn't count as Islam. This is not to say that there's some kind of anarchical situation where everybody gets to say what does. Muslims have made it singularly clear throughout history what does and doesn't count as Islam. However, we want to think about this history of debate, this history of making claims by different actors within Islamic tradition about what does and doesn't count as Islam. That is going to be our project today, with a small excerpt of the Quran and how Muslims have interpreted the Quran. As you know, this class is called Text and Interpretation. So we want to think about the text of the Quran, its context, and also how it's been interpreted by these various actors. So what we want to think about is Islam as a tradition. You use that term, which is very helpful. When we think about Islam or any religion as a tradition, the thing that we are privileging or being attentive to is that it has a history of debate and contestation within which many different actors have made claims about what counts as Islam. Okay? So that's a much more productive and generative way of thinking about religion as a tradition of argumentation and debate and contestation. So in this class, we are going to undermine religion as abstractions approach, and we're going to look at internal divisions within the tradition of Islam as well. What are some of the ways in which different actors have differed on what certain aspects of the tradition? So scripture in Islam, or the Quran literally means, the word Quran literally means recitation. And it's understood as a divine revelation that was revealed from God to humanity through the figure of Muhammad, the Prophet Muhammad. And it's not only considered a source of laws or norms, but rather it's also an object of reverence in everyday life. So you will see, if any of you have the chance to visit Firestone Library, they have some of the most beautiful manuscripts of the Quran, intricately illustrated, decorated with gold leaf paper and calligraphy. Hours and hours of labor and love have gone into the production of a single Quran for centuries and continue to do so. So that's just one example. It's been worn in miniature form as a talisman on people's bodies. It's it carries a lot of material value and reverence. But today we're going to look at it as a text primarily, but just to remember that it is also revered as an object, as the word, understood as the speech and the word of God. Now, I mentioned that it was revealed through the figure of Muhammad. And this aspect is very crucial and something I want to spend a little bit of time on today, which is this notion of understanding the context in which the Quran was revealed. So Muhammad lived in 7th century Arabia, and it's through his life that the universal ideas that you find in the Quran are communicated. Which is to say that it's through moments in Muhammad's life that the larger arguments that are made in the Quran have been made. So let's think about this a little bit. And when you think about a figure like a prophet, or a reformer, or a president, are they people that are generally content with the status quo and the way of the world? Generally not. They have something that they want to say. They have something that they want to make changes to. They're generally discontent with some aspect of the way that things are running. And so similarly, the question that we want to ask when we think about Muhammad is, what is it that he was trying to argue for? And not just what is the argument found in the Quran, what was he discontent with, but what was the problem that he was trying to answer through the message of the Quran? So we're not just interested in the answer, which is the argument made in the Quran, but what's the underlying question to which the Quran itself is an answer, right? As students of religion and students of the humanities, we want to be attentive not only to the statements and propositional statements which constitute a tradition, but what the underlying conditions are that give rise to those statements. What were those conditions? So when you think about the life of Muhammad, he lived in the year, Quran was revealed in the year 610 of the Common Era until the year 632. So that was 22 years. It was a very gradual process of revelation during the course of Muhammad's life. And when we think about Muhammad, the story that is told is that the main problem in 7th century Arabia was that society was deeply tribal in nature, and the main form of worship was idol worship, which is to be understood not just literally in the form of like physical statues or gods and goddesses which people revered, which was also the case, but there was also a fundamental reverence to the tradition of the ancestors, to the ways and life and the practices of the ancestors. And these practices included things like infanticide, which is the killing of young female babies at birth. It included gambling, debauchery, just general abuse of orphans, women, and all kinds of practices to which into which Muhammad was born. And so Muhammad himself, just a point of note, was himself an orphan, and was born into this society that was really entrenched in moral corruption, ultimately. And so this is the problem that Muhammad tries to overcome through the teaching of Islam. And Islam literally means to submit. But to submit to what? To submit to a single divine sovereign. And by submitting to that single divine sovereign, it was to free oneself from submitting to a thousand other forms of practices and forms of worship that were morally corrupt. So we often, when we think about the term submission, we think about it as a passive act. And that's why I want to reframe it just a little and say in that, and a beautiful South Asian poet from the early 19th century framed it this way, which is to say that this one submission relieves a person of a thousand other prostrations, right? So you're when you're blindly following the way of your ancestors, you can think of that as blindly prostrating yourself to the practices of the past authorities without thinking them through, without giving them due thought. And so that single prostration to the divine sovereign was a way to liberate oneself and free oneself from those other thousand prostrations. And now, Muhammad was born in Mecca, born into a tribe. He himself was, of course, part of this tribal culture. So he was born into a tribe called the Quraysh, noted on, I've just given you a handout with some key terms and some chronology, a timeline, which might be helpful once we leave. But he was born into this tribe named Quraysh, and he felt very uneasy in society. He felt very uneasy being part of this society that was participating in these different kinds of practices, and he felt alone and estranged, and he would move away from society and spend a lot of time meditating in a cave that was in that area. And on one such occasion, while he was meditating in this cave, he heard a voice, and that voice said to him, "Iqra, iqra bismi rabbika alladhi khalaq, khalaq al-insana min alaq," which translates to recite. Recite in the name of your Lord who created you, who created humanity from a drop of blood. And I'll play that for you so that you hear it as well.
اقرأ باسم ربك الذي خلق خلق الإنسان من علق.
Of course, there's a slight melody that's been associated, but imagine yourself in Muhammad's place for a minute. Here you are, born into this society, taking some time out from your life to meditate on the state of things, and you hear a voice. What are you going to think? That you're imagining it? Or that you're going crazy? He thought he was going crazy. And so he sort of stopped for a minute, and the voice recited it again. Iqra, recite in the name of your Lord who created you from a drop of blood, who created humanity from a drop of blood. And he kept repeating. Now, Muhammad was unlettered. He did not know how to read or write. So the idea of being instructed, rather commanded to recite something, was just befuddling to him. And so he kept repeating, I don't know how. And the voice insisted. And three times this happened again and again until finally he recited. And eventually he ran out of that cave shivering. It was a very physical experience. This was very physical. He was sweating, shivering, shaking. And he ran into the arms of his wife at that time, Khadija, his first wife. And it's quite fascinating to think that Khadija, who was his elder, much elder, consoled him and assured him that somebody of his character is not going crazy and is not imagining this, and that he is, if he heard this, then it must be true. So, and there's anecdotes about her taking him into her arms and covering him with a blanket. They're very detailed notes, covering him with a blanket to comfort him. And ultimately, Khadija, his wife, becomes the first Muslim, a woman becomes the first Muslim, the first person to accept the message of Islam. Now, once Muhammad begins to publicly share the message of the Quran, as he gets more and more revelations, and begins to trust in them, he begins to publicly share it with the larger community. And as you can imagine, what would be the reaction? A criticism of the practices that he was born into, the reaction would be shunning, torture, physical abuse, boycotting of him and his family. People used to pelt him with stones, with garbage. In the very same families, you would find that the father would follow Muhammad and the children would not. And so there was a breaking of families as a result of this. People became estranged from each other. It was a very difficult time. And it was so difficult, both economically, physically, socially, that Muhammad and his community felt compelled to emigrate away from Mecca. And so they emigrated, they left that region, and they left that city, and they migrated to the city of Medina. And this is a very pivotal moment in Muhammad's life. And when you translate it into the Quran is actually constituted of different chapters, 114 chapters. And some of them are revealed during his time in Mecca, in these early years, and the others are revealed in his time in Medina, in the later years. And the actual type and style and language and content of the Quranic chapters from the Meccan period and the Medinan period are radically different. So it's a very important aspect to keep in mind when we think about the Quranic text itself. And it also helps to further reinforce this point that we're trying to make today, which is the inextricability between Muhammad's life and the Quran. You can't think of one without the other. So this migration occurs, and it's a very important time in the beginning of a full-fledged Muslim community, a community that comes to see itself self-consciously as something that is, has a form and a certain set of practices and identity that's different from the community that they have just left. There are a series of battles, which I won't get into here, between the Meccan Quraysh and Muhammad's new community. And there's a final battle in the year 630, this climactic moment where Muhammad's community returns to Mecca and is successful, and they eventually reclaim that city. And there's this very iconic, symbolic moment where they re-enter the central site of the Kaaba. The Kaaba, if many of you might have seen images of the Kaaba, the black cube around which Muslims circumambulate as a very iconic ritual that one is required to do once in their lifetime. But that Kaaba, that cube, Kaaba simply means cube. That Kaaba, what do you think is inside it, by the way? Does anyone know? Yeah. It's a stone, which means what would be inside it. Right, right. So there's a, let me get everyone, yeah. Idols would be a good thought, would be a good thought. So both of you are correct, actually. So in the beginning, before Muhammad and his community came back to Mecca to reclaim it, there were hundreds of idols that inhabited that space, that the Quraysh and the tribes of Quraysh used to venerate and worship. And that single act which Muhammad and his community performed when they came back was to actually destroy all those physical idols. And this is, again, we want to think about this both as a physical act of the destruction of physical statues, but also the destruction of these ancestral practices that have really been so entrenched in society for so long. So you're absolutely right that today that stone is nothing but stone. There's nothing inside it. It's empty. It's actually empty. And it's of course the direction in which Muslims pray as a way to orient them towards something in the act of prayer, and it's referred to as the house of God. But that is not to say that it's understood to be where God lives, but rather it's the place of orientation. And historically, of course, the Kaaba was constructed by the Prophet Abraham and his son Ismail, or Ishmael, in the Muslim tradition, historical tradition. And so this is also a really crucial way for Muhammad to link himself genealogically to monotheism and to claim the same tradition and teachings as Abraham. And so to not make the argument of Islam as if it is something new, but rather to bring back the monotheism that was once argued for by none other than Abraham. So that, so this, I mentioned this story because it's doing a lot of work for us to think about the argument of Islam as something that is not, you know, it has this continuity with the past, with the Abrahamic past. And we find that, of course, in the Quran, when the story of Abraham is one of the most frequently mentioned stories, in addition to several other prophets. So let's take a pause here, and let's turn to the Quranic text that I have given you. And this is chapter 80 from 114 chapters. And let me see. Right, it's titled, He Frowned. Okay, the Quran actually doesn't have official titles, the chapters. These are just titles that the interpreters later gave the different sections to make things a bit easier for themselves. So technically, just imagine Revelation occurring, you know, in a course of 23 years, but there was nothing to, it's not as if Muhammad would be told, okay, this is chapter 22 called X. That's how we think today. So what I want you to do is to break up into groups of, let's say, four, and read this aloud to each other. And as you read this aloud to each other, ask yourselves questions about what are the main themes. What are the main themes that are being highlighted, the central themes? What is the language that is being used to communicate those themes? Okay, these two things, the themes that you identify and anything specific in the way that theme is being communicated through language. For the sake of time, let's continue this conversation together. So you don't have to move your chairs, but you could just turn around a little bit. So let's hear from you. First of all, I gave you a little bit of a challenging chapter, which is not entirely clear from the language of the chapter what's going on, which reaffirms the point of the importance of context. So the first verse reads, he frowned and turned away, right? So who's doing the frowning? Muhammad. And you got this from the paragraph above, correct? Right. But if I had had a better success at erasing that paragraph before coming here, is there anything in the text that indicates that that's Muhammad? No. Not really. And let's presume that it is Muhammad. How does that make Muhammad come across? Unaware?
Arrogant.
Why is he arrogant? According to the author of the text. Excellent. He turned away someone that was eager to learn. And by that count, Muhammad is being critiqued here for not being attentive. And why is he not being attentive if it is Muhammad? What is he attending to instead?
Non-believers
that are elders of the community, that have significant clout, let's just say, within the power structure, in the hierarchy of things, they're much higher. They're movers and shakers. So if he gets them in his camp, if he's able to convince them of his message, it will really make his life a little bit easier. So in that moment where this blind man, now the language is really interesting, right? This man is blind physically, but he sees spiritually, right? So there's this beautiful contrast that you'll see throughout this chapter, this dance of oppositions in language, blindness and seeing. We can keep going. But the idea that someone that is physically blind would be rejected in favor of someone that is socially powerful is deemed despicable to the speaker, namely God. And even someone like Muhammad would be criticized for missing that point. Now, we won't have time to get into the page that's on the back of this page. But there are two excerpts from two different commentaries on the Quran, one from the 14th century and one from the 20th century. And I'm just going to make one point about them, which is that in the 14th century, a famous commentator, scholar of the Quran, was entirely comfortable making the claim that the person being referred to in this chapter, who was frowning at the blind man and being critiqued by God, is Muhammad. He felt entirely comfortable with that kind of explanation. In the 20th century in Muslim India, we have a very important, famous scholar who felt deeply uncomfortable with that explanation, with that interpretation, and made the argument with the means of the text, using the language of the text, that in fact that criticism in the Quran is actually leveled at the elderly disbelievers, not at Muhammad. The interesting thing that I just want to make a gesture to here is that we think, well, in modern times, people would be more liberal in their interpretation, and the 14th century scholar would be more conservative in his interpretation. But in fact, what we find is that there's no such correspondence. The much more indicative might be that the 14th century scholar is writing at a time where Muslims were dominant. They had flourishing dynasties across the world. They were an imperial power. So there was no outsider to whom they had to defend Islam from whom they had to defend Islam or the language of the Quran or the claims of the Quran. So if in the Quran, Muhammad's humanity was emphasized in this moment, as this one slip that Muhammad made as a way to elevate him ultimately as a human being that can make slips in his effort to spread the teachings of the Quran, that was not a problem. That didn't create any anxiety. Whereas in the 20th century in Muslim India, where there's colonial powers, there are there is the threat of Christianity, there is the constant criticism of Islam and Muhammad in a very, very active way in order to justify colonialism. At that time, any reading of the Quran in which Muhammad would come across as failing in any way is deemed unthinkable, is deemed as a cause of anxiety. So just noticing these differing interpretations on the basis of different historical moments. Okay, just wanted to point that out. But let's go back to the text. So what are the, we've established that the person who frowned, let's go with the reading that it's Muhammad talking to a set of Qureshi elders and trying to convince them. And you have this very historically specific moment, as a group member from this group pointed out, that there's a contrast between the first and the second paragraph, is there not? The first paragraph is very historically specific to this moment, to this incident that's taking place. What happens in the second paragraph? It shifts. It zooms out. Who's the addressee here? Humanity at large. And might you be able to connect the two? Themes. What themes did people come up with that might help us connect? From the back here. Any central themes that came out from this surah, from your discussion? Yeah. Beautiful. Gratefulness and ungratefulness. Gratitude and ingratitude. And notice that gratitude is being connected to belief, right? Yeah. And ingratitude to unbelief. And if you actually think about the term disbelief in Arabic, which is kufr, I don't know if you've ever heard the term kafir, kufr, kafirun, which means disbelievers. The root of that term, kufr, means to cover something up. It means to cover something up. So if you think that through, if you take it to its logical conclusion, it's like humanity covering up the truth about themselves, or the truth with a capital T. So those individuals that cover up the truth and are ungrateful are what are disbelievers. That's what disbelief is understood as and described as. So here's this other beautiful contrast, gratitude and ingratitude of humanity compared to blindness and sight, right? Thinking about blindness and sight, the ungrateful one as being ironically not the is ironically the one that is blind to reality, right? If you're ungrateful, you cover up the truth, you disbelieve, and you are blind to reality. Other themes? Yeah.
Attention and distraction.
Tell us more.
Well, in the first paragraph, it says you allow yourself to be distracted from the blind man. And in the second one, there is a naming of all of these things, these gifts.
Hmm.
That man ignores, pays no attention to.
How lovely. How lovely. I never thought of that. That's beautiful. So the focus that is being asked of the Prophet and humanity at large in this single incident and episode of Muhammad's interaction, he lost that focus for a second. He just lost it for a second, you know, for the greater good, ultimately. But that is being what is being asked of throughout the chapter. Beautifully said. Attention and distraction. You know, one of the most frequent ways in which the Quran describes human beings is forgetful, which also connects to this notion of disbelief. Disbelief is that when you cover up the truth, you forget. You forget what the truth that is otherwise already known to you, that is already that you are already capable of knowing, made physically capable of knowing. You know, the Quran sometimes, when we think about it, if I was to ask you, you know, it's you haven't read it, but from what you know of it, what is it about? What is the Quran as a book about? How to live life truthfully.
About relationship with God,
humanity's relationship with God. That's actually much closer than what most people think it's about. Most people think it's about God, but about God. That it's a book that describes God, his power, his you know, his ability to destroy human beings, his ability to create human beings, his mercy, and all of those things. But in reality, the Quran is about humanity. It's teaching human beings about their condition through their relationship to God, as you said. So on this count, we see in this surah, just to recap, in this surah, what we find is, you know, first of all, if one was to spend a little bit more time with the surah, you would be able to see that it's organized into three sections. The first 16 verses refer to that one incident. The second 16 verses have to do with the doom of the ungrateful. And the last 10 verses shift to this end times portrait, this double portrait of, you know, faces being blackened as opposed to faces that are bright, which again takes you back to the blind, the dark, the unseeing versus the seeing. And so the chapter begins with a story, and the ending has this dramatic portrait of the end times and a reminder of things that has been given to humanity. And you'll see that the language constantly shifts from the first person to the second person, and it moves between him and you. And this is a very fundamental, distinct feature of the Quran, which on first reading can be a little confusing, but in other instances, it has the ability to constantly draw the reader in and to realize that it is the reader that is being addressed. It is not simply about a 7th century community. This book is very much for you. And it creates that sense of intimacy between the reader and the speaker. Let's go back to close to the theological problem with which we began. We began by saying that Islam doesn't say things. And the key idea here is that in this surah, we have this notion that the Prophet made a mistake. How do Muslims deal with this? How did Muslims deal with this? And I described to you that the Muslims from different moments in history dealt with this in radically different interpretations. And so what we find is that moving away from thinking about Islam as a reified, fixed abstraction that can do or say things, what we have seen today is that in Islam, different actors from different periods make claims about the different elements of what constitutes Islam. And what we took today as a case study was simply one chapter from, or rather even one verse from one chapter of the Quran, and the question of what Muslims might say about this. What kind of depiction of Muhammad is being portrayed, imagined, and celebrated in that chapter? So from this, you might be able to see that not only the understanding of the Quran, not only the understanding of a particular chapter, but the text itself and of Muhammad shifts and changes across time, depending on a set of historical conditions. So we've seen that context is crucial. Muhammad is inextricable to the Quran. The early narrative drama in which the Quran was revealed is critical to understanding specific chapters, as we noted from the surah. And thinking about Islam as an argument, as a moral argument that is at the same time an ongoing tradition of debate and contestation is what we've tried to capture today. Thank you again for your time. This was a good teaser, I think. I think that we would all agree that we would prefer to have more time to go in more depth, but I hope this gave you something to walk away with. And thank you again for your time. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I would encourage all of you to join us next week as well. We will have with us Amani Jamal, who she is the Dean of the School for Public and International Affairs at the university. Her research is amazing, but she is going to be talking to us specifically about U.S. and Muslim relations since 9/11. She's phenomenal, and I really hope that you all can be with us for that. But if we can get one more round of applause for today's session, thank you so much.
Please don't be a stranger. I teach at Princeton. I have an email address. If you ever have any questions, swing by. I'll be happy to discuss anything. So thank you. Thank you.